These events can disrupt radio transmissions, cause power outages, blackouts, and damage satellites and electrical transmission lines. We'll keep our eyes on that. In Chile, where that earthquake hit yesterday, the death toll now is 11. But our top story tonight, a major earthquake struck Tuesday about 80 miles off the coast of Northern California, prompting a tsunami warning along the Pacific coast. The 7-magnitude quake struck at 7:50 p.m. southwest of the coastal community of Crescent City, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. A tsunami warning has now been canceled, of course, but it was in effect from California to the Mexico border, north to Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Residents were being evacuated in the low-lying areas of Crescent City. In a moment, our guest will be geologist Jim Berklin. He follows earthquakes. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Geologist Jim Berklin was suspended from a California government geology job when he made a prediction that a major quake would occur during the 1989 World Series in the Oakland Bay area. It hit, and the government told him not to make any more predictions. Well, now that he's retired, he publicly states quake windows, especially on this program, Coast to Coast. Mr. Berklin uses tidal flooding tables based on lunar perigee. That's the time when the moon is closest to Earth to affect more gravitational pull on the planet. This situation, Jim, this 7 is a pretty big one, and they were worried for some time about a tsunami. Now, was that concern because they thought it really could happen, or were they just trying to protect themselves?
Well, anytime there's a quake of that size near shore, there is a potential for a tsunami, but it depends upon the type of faulting. If there's no up and down motion on the seafloor, there is no tsunami. And it's just like visualizing you have a dishpan that's full of water and a big platter in the bottom, and you pick it up by the edge, and you pull it right up, no problem. But if you try to pull it straight up, flat, then the water overtops in all directions.
You know, Jim, a year ago, way before the December 26th horrible tsunami, you and I were talking about these possibilities that were occurring. And now here they come. And, you know, we had the major one on December 26th. We've had a couple other alerts in Indonesia after the 26th. And now we get this as well. What's going on?
Well, we get 14 to 18 major quakes per year somewhere around the world. Nines are much more unusual. Of course, we hadn't had a 9 since 1964 in Alaska. Now, the Alaska quake on March 27th of 1964, Good Friday, was also accompanied by a very big killer tsunami. Mm-hmm. It was on the day of the full moon. Now, the December 26th quake of last year, with its giant tsunami, was also on the day of a full moon. And then the strongest aftershock, which happened on March the 28th of this year, was an 8.7 on the day of the full moon. Now, I see a pattern there, and a lot of my scientific colleagues just laugh it off and say, oh, no, the moon can't do anything with earthquakes. Well, the Earth's gravity triggers moonquakes. We know that for 100% sure.
Well, also, wasn't the one in Bam, Iran, a year ago?
Yeah.
That was a full moon, too, wasn't it?
Well, in fact, it was the highest possible tides on the 22nd, the 23rd of December, and I'd been warning about that all year. And then on the 22nd, we got the Paso Robles quake of 6.5 that killed those two gals in that shop in Paso Robles. And then just 4 days later, it's when we got the Bam Iran quake that killed some 40,000 people. Now, if people, the skeptics too, would just look at what happens in the past and suspect that similar things might happen in the future, and whether or not they believe in the astronomical forces from the sun and moon, which are very real, they can at least check their instruments, look at their animals, and start believing what they're seeing. Like in 1964, on the island of Kodiak, they had some new instruments to measure the electrical output from the ionosphere. And they saw on their gauges that only had been installed for a couple of months, on the afternoon of the big quake, there was a 100 gamma deflection, which they thought must be due to a faulty instrument, because nobody had seen anything more than about a 20 gamma deflection. And sure enough, a few hours later, they were evacuating the lab, and the big tsunami came into Kodiak, Alaska.
Now, what's the cause of this 7 today? I mean, there's no full moon out there.
Well, we just had the new moon. the new moon was on the 7th, and we had pretty high tides. We had 7.2-foot tides. New moon was on the 6th, and that's when we had the high tides at 7.3 feet at the Golden Gate. They normally are 4 to 4.5 feet at the Golden Gate. But that 7.3 on the 6th is nothing like what's coming up on the 23rd of this month, when we're going to have an 8.9-foot tide within 0.3 of a foot of the maximum possible at the Golden Gate. And up in Puget Sound, they're going to be about 17 feet.
Are you making a prediction for an earthquake?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Tell me.
This is a huge seismic window. On the 21st, actually, the window runs from the 20th through the 27th.
Okay.
On the 21st, we're having a coincidence of the full moon and the summer solstice, when the sun is as high in the sky as it can get. And then 31 hours later, we're going to have the perigee, the closest approach of the moon for the month. And it's a very close approach, and it's called a perigean spring tide, because you get the newer full moon, which is a spring tide, on the same day, well, just a day and a few hours later, of the close approach, the monthly perigee. And that's going to produce that tide on the same day as perigee of 8.9 feet. And it rapidly, here, look, on the 16th of this month, it's only a 4-foot tide. Then it goes 4 feet, next day 4.9, 5.9, 6.9, 7.8, 8.4, 8.7, and 8.9. Back before the Bam-Iran quake, it hit 9.2 feet, and I'd been warning about that all year, just as I've been warning all this year about the June, July, and August windows. And I've been calling for a 6-magnitude quake to hit California, most likely Southern California.
All right, now this 7 that occurred, did you see this coming?
No. I didn't have any information on the animals up there or the local geyser. Now, back in 1980, not only did we have a lot of missing cats in the Mercury News, where that quake of 7.4 also was on the day after the new moon, the day after the most missing cat ads of the year, so the cats had gotten the wind of it a few days before.
And explain your animal theory.
Okay.
For people who don't know what it is.
Well, I almost hung up on the physicist who first called me on that in September of 1979, until I realized that our cat had followed his recipe. It had disappeared 6 days before the strongest quake in the Bay Area since 1911. I'm talking about the August 6th Coyote Lake quake of 5.9. Our cat, Rocky, disappeared on my birthday 6 days before that. Did not come back for 6 months. Had returned on January 20th of 1980, having fled some other paradise because he was fatter and sleeker than when he left home. But he had fled that place only 4 days before the next 5-magnitude quake in the Bay Area. Stayed around home for one full month and disappeared on the 20th of February, just 2 days before the strongest February shock. So he did it 3 times in a row.
So they take off. Where do they go?
They get adopted. They get squashed. They get lost. They blindly run away.
I mean, are they heading for the hills somewhere, as far away as they can go?
Depends on what happens. They go off blindly like people do when the ground begins to shake. Let me out of here. They head out of their offices and homes, and they don't much know what they're doing. Had a fellow in South Africa said he was taking a bath and he ended up out in the street with just a towel around him. Not quite sure what happened. And he looked around, there were rats and mice running around the streets of South Africa in Cape Town. And the day before, a bunch of whales had beached themselves and they were covering up their carcasses with bulldozers when the quake hit. The strongest quake in the history of South Africa, back in 1969.
I got awoken Sunday. We had this 5.6 in Palm Springs.
Yeah.
A friend of mine was visiting his friend, the radio host, of course, is Frank Opinion at KTRS in St. Louis, and Frank has a place in Palm Springs.
Uh-huh.
And this person, his name's Jim Compton, has done some race reports throughout St. Louis. Well, he was there visiting, and he's waking me up early Sunday morning, not knowing whether I'm in St. Louis or back in Los Angeles, saying, oh my God, I felt this. The walls were moving. Everything was, and this was his very first experience.
It's quite an experience. But, now, if he had been looking at the Los Angeles Times Lost and Found, he would have seen that the missing dogs had risen from the 31st of May, only 3 missing dogs, to 15 the day before the quake.
So that is a pretty 500% increase plus. That's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, and that's why I see it time after time. Before the World Series quake, which I named in the paper 4 days before it happened, the missing cats, instead of being 4 or 5, went to 27, and the dogs, instead of 15 ads, went to 58.
Jim, does California have a tsunami early warning system?
I think in the northern part of the state, where we have a little bit of the Cascadia coming down from Washington, Oregon, but north of the Mendocino Trench, that's where the San Andreas Fault ends. And so the San Andreas cannot produce a tsunami unless it creates a big submarine landslide.
I mean, was there any concern, for example, that here in Southern California, that the coastlines were going to get hit with a tsunami?
Oh, they put it out. Down to San Diego, people were on alert.
So when they say all the way down to the Mexican border, they were darn serious.
Yes, at least temporarily, and then when no wave developed. But see, if you have a strike slip motion, it's like pulling the plate up vertically.
Well, how do you know, though? See, they've canceled it, but how do you know a wave may not pop up in the next hour or two?
No way. It would have been there. They travel 500 miles an hour.
All right, so it would have been here by now.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah,
now,
where they happen, right next to shore, that you have no chance to warn
people. All right, the fact that we got this 7, what are the possibilities now that there's a few more right behind it?
Oh, it's guaranteed. Yeah, we'll probably have something maybe up to 5. Often, you get aftershocks up to 1 magnitude from the main shock.
Is the main shock then generally the biggest?
That's
so you
if you later get a bigger one, then that's the main shock, and the other one was a 4 shock.
All right.
Yeah. There was something, if something like a 7.5 happened, you'd probably call it a doublet. It's, you know, because it wasn't really an aftershock. If it's only a tenth difference, you can hardly tell the difference between in 1/10 magnitude.
Does this 7 have anything to do with the big one that hit on the 26th in Indonesia? Is there any tie-in there?
No, it's just that one of the 3 most active areas for damaging quakes in the state of California are around Eureka, around southern Santa Clara County, and around Imperial County. And so you expect these kinds of quakes every few years there. And if you had, hopefully the people in Eureka would see something like mountain lions coming into town and beachings of whales. And there, of course, there have been all the strange beachings of jellyfish. And it's very odoriferous along much of the western states' beaches because of the huge deaths of jellyfish.
80 miles off coast, is that considered pretty close for an earthquake in the ocean?
Oh, well, it's out by the trench. I mean, the ridge is out 80 miles.
Right.
And the trench is something less than that, where the new crust is absorbed underneath the continent. So any one of those places, the ridge, the trench, or inland of the trench, can cause large earthquakes. Now, the shallower they are, usually the worst situation, because, well, if you're 100 miles deep, it's like living 100 miles away from it, pretty much.
Did the coronal mass ejections that we've been following over the last couple days, the one did not hit us that occurred yesterday, now there's another one on the way that could hit us tomorrow, the day after, do they have anything to do with these?
You know, 6 or 8 years ago, I would have scoffed at any possible relation. And then I got a hold of the largest coronal mass ejections in the history since 1960. I think it was 73 to 97, something like that.
You started charting them, didn't you?
Yes. And there was one that was an X9 on the day of that 7.4 quake in Eureka in 1980. And there was an X13 on the day of a 6.2 down by Gilroy in 1984. And there was an X13 on just 2 days after the World Series quake. So I think it would make more sense if the coronal mass ejection came before the quake. But we don't know what's going on in the sun before the ejection actually occurs. And maybe there's huge magnetic change that affects the ionosphere.
Now, if this all happens at the same time, as it appears in this particular case, a week from a full moon that we had a week ago, we have a couple coronal mass ejections and all that. I mean, the timing there is there.
It's a magnificent puzzle, and we just keep adding these pieces. And so many of my colleagues really ignore very important pieces. When I went to Peru to see the total eclipse of the sun in 1994. After seeing this great, about a 4-minute eclipse, we came back on the bus and stopped in the Sacred Valley of the Incas on our way to Machu Picchu, and the Peruvian guide got up in front of the lodge and said, "I'm so glad you were able to see our eclipse. We in Peru have a tradition. We watch the eclipse, and then we wait for the earthquake." And I said, "Whoops, would you say that again," from my video camera, and raised it up. And she gave me a little interview. The next day, a 6.2 hit southern Peru. Now, when I went back to New Brunswick, Canada, where they had a 5.9 quake, the strongest in 126 years, on the 9th of February in 1982, near the Bay of Fundy, it was on the day of the eclipse of the moon. So I went back there and I stopped the geology department. I said, "I'm Jim Berkland. I have an idea about the timing of quakes in general, and yours in particular." And their professor said, "Well, it was on the day of the eclipse of the moon. When the tides on the Bay of Fundy were over 55 feet, we think that extra stress triggered a weak place in the fault." And I said, "That's my idea. Would you please come to California and talk to some of my colleagues?"
Please, yeah.
Yeah.
Is this planet shattering?
No.
It is not.
No.
No need for us to worry and panic about that.
You know, if a nearby asteroid might change my sanguineity on it. But when I say that we have 14 to 18 major quakes a year.
That's normal,
and
right?
Usually one great earthquake a year. Now, last year was pretty unusual when in mid-December, an 8.3 hit down south of the New Zealand. Now, most people ignored the fact that there was an amazing whale beaching in southern New Zealand, you know, on the island of, south of Australia,
okay.
Tasmania,
yeah.
And also in Australia. Those three places had hundreds of whales and dolphins beaching themselves, and within a week or so, you got this 8.3 quake, and then the following week is when we had the 9.3 up at Sumatra, and of course the animals there got away from that tsunami. So the animals are aware, and we are stupid if we ignore what Mother Nature tries to tell us.
Well, we've got to set up a system, Jim, and I know you've been screaming for one.
Well, I think my book's coming out in December by Cal Ori. It's the man who predicts earthquakes, Jim Berkland. Not renegade, but maverick geologist.
Maverick.
I like that.
Sounds better. Sounds
yeah, I like
better.
That much better. So that has lots of information in there that people will be able to follow, and you can predict your own earthquakes.
Jim, give us your website. Give us your website. I'm going to keep you for the hour, by the way. All right?
Good.
We're going to take phone calls, but give us your website.
Please. It's Syzygy. That's lining up of the sun, moon, and earth. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y. S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y, and then my initials, J-O-B, and you can use .com, .org, or .net. And I've had 135 million hits since 1997 on the message board, which we're setting up for people to provide input, whatever it is, whether it's dreams, or whether it's headaches, animal observations, compass changes, groundwater changes, the spring change temperature or water quality, you smell sulfur. You put all of these things on. If we get, 10 different clues, as I did before the World Series quake.
True.
Then you can come out and you can go public with your prediction. I gave it 85% chance for a 6.5 to 7 to occur within the World Series week.
Well, I've jotted down this window you've just given us about the end of this month, so
yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Oh, I feel about like I did before the World Series quake with all these things, these precursors.
That's not good. Stay with us. Jim Berkland is our guest. We're going to open up the phone lines now, those of you who just have a general question for Jim, but also those of you who might have had some of the signs, the symptoms that Jim's been talking about. In as much as this 7 just happened, let's see if you did feel some strange things. What about your animals? Any of you have animals that just took off, disappeared over the last few days? Check in with me. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment with our guest this hour, Jim Berkland. Next hour, for the rest of the program, our guest will be Michael Cremo. human evolution. He believes that man has been on this planet for hundreds of millions of years. That'll be at the top of the hour. But Jim Berklin, your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. This book is free for all subscribers from Coast to Coast. It has lots of additional information, including an exclusive article about why the Orson Welles radio broadcast might have been a planned psychological exercise in the manipulation of mass populations. To become a member of the Filament Book Club, call this toll-free number, 1-888-95-E-BOOK. They will, by the way, give you a free electronic book, a device that lets you download all these books. Or you can go to their website, which is linked up with coasttocoastam.com, right there at the bottom of our homepage. It's Filament, F-I-L-A-M-E-N-T, bookclub.com. Jim Berklin's website, by the way, is easy to get to, too. If you go to our website, look under tonight's guests. It's linked up right with him. Back in a moment. Jim, can you explain the difference between some of the faults on this planet, earthquake faults? I mean, are they different? Is there like a slip fault and a thrust fault? What are they?
Oh, vast differences, yes. The one that we hear most about are the long strike slip faults, where things move horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
And they can move, as you look across a fault, it can move to the right for a light lateral fault, or to the left for a left lateral fault, like okay. This down in the Garlock fault. But those, there's very little up and down motion. Over the millions of years, though, that faults often exist. There is a lot of vertical motion too, which explains why there's granite at the surface on the west side of the San Andreas Fault many places. Well, that granite formed several, 10, 15 miles deep. And so it had to get to the surface by vertical motion and erosion. Well, anyway, most of the current movement is horizontally on those the longest faults. The ones along the trenches are entirely different because it's an underthrusting where the ocean plates dive underneath the continental plates or island arcs at a fairly low angle, usually maybe 30 degrees is fairly typical. And as it dives down, it makes a big warp in the Earth's crust, and it may make these deep trenches of 20,000 feet deep sometimes.
Oh, my God. Are they both dangerous, though?
Well, those are the most dangerous ones because the up-and-down motions give you the tsunami.
Okay.
And they also are very shallow at the trench level, and then as they inclined under the continent, they get deeper and deeper and deeper, finally way inland, like in Brazil off South America. By the time that they're underneath Brazil, they're a couple hundred miles deep. So I don't think Brazil's ever had a killer quake. But and then there's the fault lines that, like on Death Valley, where there's a fault on either side of the valley, where the valley drops down and the mountains raise up. Those
right.
are called normal faults because it's like the valleys respond to gravity. And what's on the down-dropping side is pulled by gravity, essentially. A thrust fault is a type of reverse fault. A reverse fault is where, instead of responding to gravity with a tilted fault surface,
mm-hmm.
the upper plate moves up.
It goes the wrong
goes
way.
Goes backwards,
yeah.
up the inclined slope. And if that inclined slope is less than about 30 degrees, then they call it a thrust fault.
Let's take some calls, Jim. You ready?
Yes, indeed.
Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. Where are you calling from?
Hi, George. I'm calling from just south of Santa Barbara. I was actually on chat with you tonight when they evacuated our hotel.
Oh, you were on the Streamlink chat. Okay, hi.
Yeah.
They evacuated you, huh?
Yeah, ran us all out to the parking lot, and a few minutes later let us come back in.
Must have been a scary feeling for the moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, especially when you're just visiting here on business.
Well, if you're in upper floor, they should have let you stay in the hotel, for heaven's sake.
I know. You would think that. Well, we're right on the beach, so I guess they... They got the warning and then just kind of reflex.
Well, it's good practice, like they say, and that doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than when they have in the old days, for sure, they had a tsunami warning. Everybody would rush to the beach.
That's true. Well, some of them did that on the 26th, as a matter of fact, some of the pictures I saw.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I actually had two questions. One, I wanted to know, on your model, do you equally base your model on the different factors, or do you kind of rank them, are tide more important in your model, or the animals, or do they all rank?
That's a good question. Now, I first got this revelation about the tides on January 8th of 1974 when I read about extremely high ocean tides, and I thought that with the sun and the moon, and the near sun and near moon at the same time, triggering these extremely high tides in the ocean, they might also cause the solid earth to warp, and that might trigger faults into action. So I looked into 6 quakes in the previous about 4 months that had greeted me into the Bay Area, and they all 6 fit this wild idea. So I made my first prediction on January 8th, 1974, for a 4 to 5 magnitude quake within a week, and it hit 2 days later. And I thought, this is simple. And so in February, I made another prediction, and that one hit, and I was 6 out of 8 for 1974. So the tides can only tell me when, because tides are worldwide. And
yeah.
Earth tides are certainly worldwide. Even in Kansas has an Earth tide. So I used that for 5 years, and then a physicist with Xerox alerted me to the fact that animals seem to react, and the pets would run away and show up in the newspaper as lost and found items.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost hung up on him when he first called me, because I was having dinner and I was tired, and it was a wild idea until I realized that our cat, Rocky, had disappeared exactly as he had said might happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it made a believer out of me when Rocky came home just before the next 5 magnitude quake. So then I started using animals regularly. In fact, I have 2-3 catalogs now full of lost and found data daily since 1979. And then I started paying more attention to other things, such as radon gas release, and we had some people evaluating that, patterns of small earthquakes, beachings of whales, homing pigeons getting lost, changes in hydrothermal water, such as warm springs, hot springs, geysers. And so now I have a battery of about 10 different things that I use, and the more that occur, the greater up goes my confidence. So before the World Series quake in January, I said, look out for October 14th to 21st for 3.5 to 5.5.
You know, the USGS, though they will admit that animals act in a very strange way, they will not go that extra mile and say that they can help predict earthquakes.
Well, yes. And they actually had a study for 4 years called Earthquake Watch. And they had 1,800 observers volunteered up and down the state. And we would fill out daily forms of 0 to 4. 4, I've never seen this before. 3 is pretty unusual. And then you had a hotline phone number to call, and it would be tape recorded. Well, on the 7th of November in 1980, I used it for the first time to call the hotline and make a prediction of a 6.5 or better for Northern California within a week because of the most missing cats of the year, the new moon, and the previous 2 new moon and full moon syzygies had both produced major quakes around the world. And also the geyser, Olga Kolbeck's geyser in Calistoga, just about 15 miles from me, that day had the longest gap between eruptions on history. 3 hours and 12 minutes. It normally was 40 minutes between eruptions. 3 hours and 12 minutes, and the 2.5 hour gap of about 5 years earlier met a 5.8. So I'd plotted this, and this looked like the 7 magnitude quake, but we hadn't had a 7 for 28 years in California, and we hadn't had a 6.5 in 14 years in Northern California, but I made a prediction of a 6.5 or better on the tape recording, and when I checked later to see how the, you know, they put that down, I predicted that quake in Eureka on the 8th of November of 1980. And they said, Jim, unfortunately, I believe your call was on that tape we lost in the mail.
Oh,
the only one they'd lost in 4 years operation. And they mailed it all the way from Menlo Park to Palo Alto.
Go figure. First time caller line. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Miguel. I'm calling from El Paso. I had a question. I think it was last year in California, or on Baja, in a town called Rosarito. There was a off-the-coast tremor. I don't recall if it was 5 point or 6 point, and we felt it in California. I was at work at the time, and my wife was at home, and I remember, you know, that was new to California, so that was just an experience in itself. I just wanted to know if he had also predicted that one or not.
Well, I don't know what the date was, but if you 6, you might feel for 200 miles, 240 miles maybe. A 7 was definitely, that Eureka quake was felt 300 miles south in San Jose. So I recognize that people can feel larger quakes for, you know, great distances. In fact, that's my rule of thumb, is how far do the animals do weird things before the quake?
Right, how far
about
out?
The same distance that people feel the quake when it occurs. It turned out that's what the Chinese found out also.
Maybe even a little further. They're pretty sensitive.
Well, some people, you know, I haven't proven that. That Eureka quake is the longest one I have on record that clearly showed me. Now, the Northridge quake produced a lot of missing animals in San Jose. And the World Series quake produced a lot of missing animals down in Los Angeles. So I know that a quake close to 7 magnitude is sensed by animals at least 354 miles away.
Well, and we know what happened to the animals that were on all those islands in Indonesia.
Yes, and now last December, suddenly a lot of people that were laughing at me before are paying a little more attention.
That's true. East of the Rockies, welcome, and where are you?
Yes, I'm in Houston, Texas.
Go ahead, sir.
To Texas.
KTRH. A few days ago on the Coast to Coast show, I heard that some Japanese explorers, I guess, are trying to drill into the core of the Earth's surface, and I was wondering if that would affect more earthquakes in different places other than, you know, where you're used to getting them.
Well, I think you'd see they were drilling into the mantle, and nobody's going to hit the core.
Okay.
4,000 miles down.
I got you.
If they do, we're in trouble, Jim.
They're not going to have problems, though, with earthquakes that weren't in places?
Well, see, they have drilled around volcanoes, and the lava or the magma as it comes up tends to congeal, and you don't get big fountains of it. And they do try to get around some geothermal areas. They drill in to get geothermal power. They make hot water that turn generators and steam. But I'd like to see that article about what the Japanese are doing. They certainly have plenty of their own volcanoes.
Yeah, thanks a lot for taking my call.
All right, thank you, too. It's not like oil popping out, is it?
No.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, I didn't really get, Jim, your explanation of why your technique didn't work for this latest quake. You had said something in L.A., in the Southland area of California, and you had said that you hadn't had access to the, animals lost and found. But I thought, well, for June, July, and August that you're predicting, you didn't base that on animals lost at all.
No, see, that's just as I did before in 1989. Early on, months ahead of time, 10 months ahead of time, I said, look out for this period. Had an 80% confidence it'd be a 3.5 to 5.5. And then as we approached it, and we had homing pigeons getting lost and whales beaching themselves in San Francisco and Santa Cruz and deer coming onto people's patios and seagulls flying miles inland and especially the missing pets going about 10 times normal, that just caused my confidence level to go up and my concern, and that's when I had to go public and put it in the newspaper. So, yes, indeed, the tides tell me when, but they don't tell me where or how big.
Oh.
Now, the other factor is, you know, in Southern California, Los Angeles has had 37.25 inches of rain. They should have about 16 inches for this last year. And in June 30th, it's the second highest rainfall record on record in history for Los Angeles.
And if we get any more, it'll go over.
Yeah, and the pattern has been, according to a paper that came out in the late 70s by some USC scientists, they found 12 earthquakes of 6 magnitude in Southern California had all been preceded by a couple of years of drought followed by an extremely heavy rainfall year. And that was 12 out of 12. There had been some 6 magnitude quakes without that pattern, but all 6 that did occur did follow that pattern. So based on that, kind of, I predicted a 6-plus for Santa Clara County in 1984 following our record rainfall year of 1983, and sure enough, it happened.
I just one other quick point. I'm a physics student, and I've been really looking into the effects, the electromagnetic effects of other planets other than the moon and the sun. And I was wondering if, you know, maybe what the other planets are doing in terms of alignment or oppositions or whatever might actually be factoring in, you know, and be another big piece of the puzzle.
Well, there you go to astrology. And I've yet to have an astrologer predict a quake successfully to me. They've often post-dicted them after they happen, saying, oh, well, this is quite, Uranus was trying the Neptune.
They may not have the system down, and you're the guy who knows how to follow patterns.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, I think you should, I don't know, maybe it's worth considering. I don't know.
Well, I consider it. I'm always open to it. But and I know very bright people are into that kind of thing. There was a General Electric fellow, what was his name, a simple name, a Smith or something. He looked at the planets and their effect on the radio communication, and he found an effect there. So I can't, you know, totally discount it, but I have not seen it work for earthquakes.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. You're up with Jim Berkland. Hi there.
Hello, it's Jeff from Ferguson, Missouri.
Hey, Jeff. Hi.
I was wondering how, since St. Louis is not in the on the East Coast or anything like that, how is it possible to predict quakes, and do you have a window time frame for the St. Louis area?
Well, the window is pretty much the same as here on the coast for St. Louis area. You are in the mid-continent, and apparently close to the Mississippi, what was called an ancient geo-suture, where maybe something started like in the Red Sea and Persian Gulf, but didn't complete. So it's an ancient fault line that kind of healed, but that it still has some activity in it. Plus, you have the very active zone coming down the St. Lawrence River. And if you turn that St. Lawrence River basin into a finger, boy, it points right down to St. Louis there.
Oh.
So there seems to be some convergence of weak places. And that first big quake on December 16th of 1811 was just the day after the new moon. And people talked about strange lights in the sky, an extremely warm, sultry day. Well, not extremely warm, but a surprisingly warm and sultry before that quake. Now, I must say that I just had a call from a lady here in within, 20 miles of where I live, named Melissa, who said on Friday night there was a generally observed pillars of light near Mount St. Helena, not St. Helens, but St. Helena near Santa Rosa, up towards the geysers geothermal area. And it looked like white lights, like lightning, going from the ground upward, but there were no clouds, no thunder. And it was seen by dozens and dozens of people. I wish I had seen it, but it lasted for at least an hour. Now, I do know that the geyser at Calistoga, which was nearby to where she saw those lights, did have its longest eruption cycle in history. I don't know about just this in the last few days.
A few moments here, Jim. Anything new with the Yellowstone caldera?
I wish. I wish we were being leveled with from the scientists. But when they tell us that the bottom of Lake Yellowstone was 100 feet higher than the last time they measured it, and neglect to tell us when the last time they measured it was, and that they weren't even going to get around to measuring it again for another 6 months, that's a little...
They just had a major mudslide, too.
Did they?
Huge. Oh. They shut down one of their major roads getting in and out.
Well, was it extremely heavy rainfall, I imagine?
I don't know. Did it rain there in that area?
Well, yeah. To have a mudslide, you have to have rain unless you have a broken water line or something.
Or something up there.
Yeah. It was interesting, you know, that down in Laguna Beach where the landslide occurred,
mm-hmm.
very close to where the one occurred in 1978, that somebody had written a book called Slide, and it talked about a big landslide in Laguna Beach, and many of the details were almost identical to what actually happened about two or three years after the book was written.
History repeats itself. Yeah. Jim, let's follow up with you on that week of the 20th and see what happens.
Yes, if people want a sample copy of my newsletter, just send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, put a couple of bucks in it, send it to Jim Berkland, P.O. Box 1926, in the little town of Glen Ellen, G-L-E-N-E-L-L-E-N, California, and the zip is 95442, and it's there on my website, too, if they get there.
Very good. And that website linked right up at coasttocoastam.com.